meeting a lot of foreign investors and telling them that we sell onion oil and, you know, in shampoo. And they would be like, seriously, right? Onion? Yeah. And, are you serious? Are you selling onion to consumers? I mean, like, so some of that was very, very new to the world. Right? Mm. A lot of people talk about, you know, hey, getting investors is hard, getting funding is hard. But reality is getting great people to join you in your journey is actually equally hard. Right? And now, if you're an entrepreneur, shayad ladki mil jayegi in terms of getting married. Yeah. People won't say that, you know, oh God, you know, he doesn't do anything. Right? Okay. Wow. One truth that I know, but the world doesn't know. The entire world doesn't know. Wow.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast, where we talk to founders from across the Indian startup ecosystem and understand how they build their companies. Today, I have with me a very special guest. Join me in welcoming the co-founder and CEO of India's largest new age consumer brand company. Join me in welcoming Varun Alagh, the co-founder and CEO of Mamaearth. Thank you so much, Varun, for joining me. Very delighted to be hosting you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to hear that, Varun. And I think I first hosted you about 2.5 years ago. And that was the time when the second brand of Mamaearth was only launching. This was Dermaco. And you were, you know, 1/3 of the size of where you are at right now. Things have significantly changed since then. Mamaearth has become a household name. And we've seen 1,000 crores and plus in revenue. Everybody in the country, when starting a consumer brand, thinks of not HUL as their target now, but Mamaearth. And I want to understand how you've got in here and how the journey has looked, what your thinking processes are, and how you've been able to build this new age HUL in the country, right? Where we might start, because the story is widely known, where, you know, there was a very personal struggle of not being able to find the right products for your child. And that is how the brand had given inception. I'd love to know, if we look back at the last 7 years, if you had to point very hard truths about what got you here, right? The significant milestones and what got you there. That would be very interesting to just summarize the journey before we go deeper.
You know what? I think before milestones, I would say there are certain DNAs or values, right?
Absolutely.
Which I believe, when I look back over our journey, I would say have been very, very core part of these 7 years and haven't really changed. Right? Which is what is the real body which moved, right? And then, of course, we kept doubling down on different things at different points of time, and which would be or can be referred to as milestones, right? I think from a values perspective or from certain principles perspective, right? If I was to state a few, I would say one, listening to consumers, right? Okay. So the whole journey started with us listening to our own problems, right? And recognizing the fact that brands were not addressing those problems, right? The problem could have been of a proposition, which is that parents were not being able to find certified safe products, right, in India. Right? Or the problem could have been in form of not understanding the cultural nuances of this country, right? And brands just serving the Indian consumer with whatever they were sort of building globally. Both of these are nuances which were kind of, you know, insights or problem statements that consumer has had. And we listened to them to start on this journey, which is how Mamaearth was born as the Asia's first MadeSafe certified brand. But also on the other side, because we were looking at building for Indians, and we clearly went on the path of recognizing these small cultural nuances that we have, right? The fact that we use hing and coconut oil on our baby's tummies, or the fact that we use haldi and besan ka upton on our faces, you know, on the most magical day of our lives, which is wedding, to look good, right? And that is the core hard belief that we have in that, you know, mix at home. We use curd on our hair, we use onion juice on our hair, right? Now that's us, right? A lot of places outside, you know, and I remember meeting a lot of foreign investors and telling them that we sell onion oil and, you know, in shampoo, and they would be like, seriously, right? Onion? Yeah. And, are you serious? Are you selling onion to consumers? I mean, like, so some of that was very, very new to the world, right? Mm. But it has been true to us for hundreds of years, right?
Absolutely.
So I think that first insight of listening to consumers, right, has been a core DNA for us in our journey.
Right.
And over time, the way we have shaped, right, be it our choices of entering into newer categories like, you know, hair care, skin care, happened because we were listening to consumers all the time. Right? Or be it the development of newer brands, right? It happened because we were listening to consumers. Right? When we were talking to consumers, we were understanding that the same consumer, right, who was using a natural face wash, right, when she had acne, right, she wanted a science-based serum which can help solve the acne problem. Right?
Yeah.
Or when she was stepping out in the sun, she was expecting a more derma-oriented sunscreen which can provide sun protection.
Right? Yeah.
Or when she's now using makeup, she wants long stay. Right? Just natural won't do. Right? So I think that told us that the same consumer is buying into different propositions. Right? And hence, we need to provide different sharp propositions to her. So I think the one big journey DNA, so to say, has been listening to consumers. And I think the second big DNA that has been for us is the belief that data and technology is disrupting how consumer brands are built in this country.
Right.
For the longest time, while consumers were buying, right, brands were just not fully aware of who is buying, why they're buying, in what kind of cohorts they're buying. I was a part of, you know, some of the largest FMCG companies in the country, and I've been on the other side as a brand manager there. And I remember sort of creating these large pen profiles, right? And selling in India, you create one pen profile that, you know, Sunita ji in Meerut is, you know, housewife who likes to shop and all of that, right? Because the reality is there are hundreds of pen profiles which are existing.
Yeah.
India itself, right, can be divided into like 30 different countries from a behavior perspective, from a cultural nuances perspective, from a language perspective. And hence, that one pen profile doesn't do justice, right? So we have to use technology to understand these consumers and what kind of content works for them and what kind of marketing works for them better. And which is where I think the big belief, right, that data and technology will disrupt this ecosystem, and has been a very big driver of us, right? So firstly, it started with, of course, digital marketing, and the fact that we could see sharp cohorts and target this consumer very sharply, right, and reach out to certain cohorts which were evolved consumers who are interested in this kind of a proposition. Evolved to, you know, e-commerce as a distribution, and which opened up the fact that now you're not limited by physicality of a consumer.
Right.
Just most brands 10 years ago would just start with top 6 metros, right? Or probably even just one metro. And then after years, right, would expand into the next set of cities. Right? Reality is the content with the smartphone is reaching out to entire India. And hence, why should they not have access to products which are evolved or which are, you know, suitable for their kind of needs, right? Their aspirations are amazing, right?
Yeah.
But they shouldn't need to travel 200 kilometers to a big city, right, to actually get the product. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is where the e-commerce insight that we are able to deliver across 25,000 pin codes, right? And hence, why would we limit our distribution? Right? Was the second big technology disruption that we built on top of. Right? And the third for us was our D2C. Right? We realized that, you know, when we have our own platform, our own website, right, the amount of consumer education, right, and the amount of, you know, impact that we are able to create in those journeys, right? By actually bringing the consumer, showing a lot of information about how the product is built, consumed, showing a lot of social proof around how others who have used the product have felt, right? And being able to, you know, recommend the right kind of products according to their needs, right? As well as being able to show a difference that they are making by tying up with our brand, right? Was something which was a third piece that we doubled down on. So I think this whole data and technology and our belief in that being a disruptor was the second big, you know, value or DNA that has been there across. I think if I would say the third one, would have to be just innovation, right? I think that is another DNA which has been a very strong part of our belief system, right? That we need to understand what the consumers are looking for next, right? And we need to be significantly ahead of the curve, right? In being able to provide that, right? Be it in terms of the ingredients they're looking for, be it in terms of the kind of textures they're looking for, be it in terms of the kind of problems they're looking for solving, right? And being able to provide a mix which serves that, right? So I think that has been the third value, which has kind of, you know, gotten us here. And the fourth value that I would say is expanding distribution in line with where the consumer wants us to be, right? So it is not just about the kind of products that consumer wants you to provide, but also where is the consumer wanting to buy you, right? If you push the consumer too much, so for example, there are early adopters, e-commerce consumers who are early in this journey or who are evolved in this journey and would be happy to buy from from e-commerce kind of platforms. But then there are a lot of consumers who still prefer to buy in physical environments, right? And for them, the touch feel of the product, being able to sort of see it, right, and then buy it is more important, right? If you push that consumer, no, I will only be available in online and this is the only place where you can buy me, right? It introduces friction. You're taking choice away from them, right? And whenever you take choice, right, that makes the journey more expensive, right? And you have to spend a lot more money to actually convince them to buy you through another channel, right? So as the brand graduates in its journey, as awareness increases for the brand, and you're now in the consideration set of this consumer, right? You have to graduate your distribution in line, right? So I think that's the other principle that we have followed, that we will be available wherever our consumer wants us to be available, right? Rather than tying ourselves to be saying, no, we are an X-channel company, right? We are not a channel company, we're not a D2C company, we're a company which exists to provide amazing brands and products to consumers, right? And hence, whatever the consumer wants, wherever they want it, right, is where we will go, right? So I think those would be the few values which have kind of gotten us here, right? Milestones, I would say, has been just, you know, when we started, we never imagined we would be at this level of scale in such a short time. We were just focusing on getting the next set of consumers happy and delighted, right? And hence for us, milestones have been, you know, just sort of, you know, setting the next goal, right? We would have broken this journey down from starting to saying, hey, can we do, you know, 1 lakh per day sales, right? To saying that, you know, can we do 1 crore a month sales, right? And preparing for that, planning for that, getting the entire team and ecosystem excited to that. To saying, can we do, you know, 5 crores a month sales? What will it take, right? How much time will it take? What will we need to do, right? And similarly, just setting the next milestone right? While keeping a very strong eye on one, quality, right? That, you know, we measure NPS, we call our consumers, we are always checking for our ratings and reviews, that, you know, that is something that we should not be breaking as we scale, right? And second, efficiency, right? We are a fairly middle-class company in terms of our frugality and our values. So it's always been important that as we scale, right, we should only get better, right, at being more efficient rather than getting worse off. So I think those would be the milestones that we've chased, right, which are more like what is next.
Fair. No, I think that is such a great summary of what personifies a legendary brand, as they say, right? Talking to consumers, using new age technology as a lever to get and understand data better, and then doing the right things in terms of channel distributions, etc. There was this, I think there was a brief reel by Shantanu where he mentions about Mama Earth, and he talks about exactly these pointers as to what goes into making a great brand. And I think you've summarized it so well. I want to double click on one of those things, and maybe one of the things which you not mentioned, which is to say the team aspect of it, right? To manage the kind of scale you're at and to build something that has not been done before, especially as a new age company, is a hard challenge in itself. How do you groom and get the right set of, talent? Because I've also, while I was doing my research, heard from a bunch of people that Varun is one of the best leaders there can possibly be, with a very strong vision as to what the company needs to look like 5-10 years from today. So how do you groom talent to be ready for the next challenge? And how do you build an organization of this scale and stature? What would you have to say, Varun?
I would say three things. One, especially towards early part of the journey, and attracting talent is an equally large challenge as attracting investors, right? I mean, a lot of people talk about, getting investors is hard, getting funding is hard, but reality is getting great people to join you in your journey is actually equally hard, right? And hence, as a leader, you have to balance your time and be able to invest your time in attracting the right kind of people. And three kind of people that, I've kind of, encountered when I'm hiring, right? And one is the young and hungry cohort, right? This is the cohort which really are people who don't come with some very relevant experiences for the roles that you're looking for. And, but they have the right skills and the right attitude. And they're willing to learn, right? They're willing to put in effort and willing to learn. And these guys, are great for what you can call transformational stints, right? And, you put them into one stint which has this certain kind of problem statement attached to it, right? And you make sure that they're excited and you give them the right directions, right, as to, what is it that we're trying to solve and how will it sort of, help the business and excite them towards it. And they will be at it very hard. Right? Now, that problem statement might take 3 months or 6 months or 9 months to solve. Right? But once it's done, right, they're ready for taking up another transformational stint. Right? Then there are people who come from very skilled, experienced backgrounds, right? And there are functions which specifically need skilled and, experienced Correct. Background folks, right? I mean, a R&D function, right? You might not want to put a general young and ugly hustler there, right? Similarly, a finance function, right? You would want to put in a professional who has the right background and expertise, a CA, right, so to say, in that sort of domain, right? So there are domains, right, which actually need you to have functional expertise, right, and where you want experience, right? And there are domains like, for example, sales, marketing, right, even product, right, which is be it technology or innovations, right, where actually young and hungry folk can do really well. Right? So these two, and these guys then do foundational stints, right? The expertise of professionals, right? You would want them to do one deep stint for at least 3 years before they're actually given another opportunity, because it takes time to really set up a function and do justice to a function where some of this expertise is required. And then the third kind of people that you hire during the journey are leaders, right? Who would actually who would actually act as leaders of multiple functions, or who would actually take up mandate of taking the span of control away from you, right? Because finally you can't be managing directly the entire organization. Now, in this journey, what I would say from a talent perspective is one, we've been long on people, and we've actually given them opportunities which they themselves didn't believe they could do, and and they have surprised both themselves and us, and when they have been able to do well at that, and that feeling of being able to succeed at something that you'd never done, right, is an amazing feeling, and it doesn't go away, right? And the fact that we had the confidence in taking the chance, and we were brave enough in taking that chance, right, has really helped us build a talent pipeline which then goes very deep, right, because of that, right? Secondly, we've again been very long on the young and hungry attitude folks, right? And wherever we come across that kind of talent, right, we then don't worry as much about do we have a role or not, how will we sort of, we believe that, they will find their place in the system. We just need to, excite them, charge them enough, and give them problem statements which are great, and they will shape their sort of careers. And we've had, again, great, folks who have shaped their careers, folks who were young out of college, right, to folks who had 3-4 years of experience, right, who are doing amazing jobs at the company now. And of course, the third piece has been we've tried to hire for tomorrow rather than yesterday, right? Because you have to, in a fast-growing organization especially, right, you have to look forward and think about what will we look like in 6 to 12 months' time, right? And what will we look like in 2 years' time, and are we hiring someone for this position keeping that in mind, right? Because if you're hiring for today or even worse yesterday, right, which is the problem that you've already faced on people front, right, then you have a possibility that the role will outgrow the person too soon, right? Yeah. And it is not the person's problem. It is the fact that they didn't get enough time, right, to actually grow themselves for the role. And hence, it's your fault, right? You didn't recognize how fast you're growing, and would you outgrow the person as well, right? So those would be actually the positive principles. On the other hand, we've also been, we've also been cognizant, right, that we will make mistakes. Right? So when you're hiring at that pace, right, you have to accept that you will make mistakes, right? But you also need to be okay that you don't need to be married to your mistakes. Right? And hence, you should have very quick check-ins, right? So we have a step process called pit stop, right? 15 days into someone's joining and 90 days into someone's joining, right? We have a two-way conversation, right? Where we meet them from their side to understand if they're settling well, if they understand the role, if they have everything that is needed to succeed in that role. And from our side, from a manager's side, right, it is a process where you can clearly point out if there are things which you imagined to be a certain way, right, but are not shaping. And if in pit stop one you point it out, that's then a 75-day window till pit stop two, where you want to see visible change. Right? And these are largely attitudinal issues or, work ethic issues, etc., which come up there. Right? But if by pit stop two you don't see that changing, right, you should take a call of parting ways rather than, making it difficult for both of you. Right? So don't get married to your mistakes. And second, thing that I would say is, sometimes roles do outgrow people, and as a leader, it is your responsibility, right, to make it right for the organization. You're not doing justice to even the person who is in that role, because if they're not succeeding because the role has outgrown the person, then you're responsible for either giving them another role in the system where they can succeed, right, or having that honest conversation, right, that this might not be the right place now for them. Right? Yeah. That's also important. And that's important for both of you. Right? It is not just important for the organization, right? But it is your responsibility to make sure that the other individual does not fail. Right? If you're setting them up for failure, right, you just gave them a bad year, right? Because you didn't have that honest conversation. So I think that's also, so some of these is how at least, you know, we've looked at having certain people principles. There are a lot more, right, around learning, around sort of, you know, engaging, around external orientation, right? But I would say these are the in crux.
Got it. Oh, I think that's one of the most succinct and yet elaborate explanations of people excellence that I have heard in a while. Thank you so much for, I think, walking us through the entire distinction between hungry folks and expertise and how you make a conducive environment for them to succeed as well. And that goes to show what a legendary organization needs to do. I think coming to the other piece, right, one thing that has been evident and, you know, appeals to the audience as well is the role of Shark Tank in what Mamaearth has become. And you'd be able to tell us better because you've been able to see it from both sides as somebody who's consumed what Shark Tank has to offer and also somebody who's had the chance to see behind the scenes. What was the role of Shark Tank in making Mamaearth a household brand? How do you look at certain these blasts of, you know, mass recognition in ensuring brands get a lot of visibility and a lot of tier 2-3 extension, as they say, right? What does that do?
Actually, for us, before Ghazal came on Shark Tank, for 2 years before that, we had already been doing deep television. Right.
Right.
And hence, we were actually driving a fair amount of awareness in Tier 3 and beyond. In fact, before she went to Shark Tank, we already had 60% plus of our business coming from Tier 2 and beyond.
Right? Wow.
So the awareness piece was not a challenge. Right? But I think it was a great platform, right, to tell probably the story from the founder's perspective.
Right? Right.
Because otherwise, our products do the talking. Right? But sometimes when you, especially for startups, right, the big differentiation can be the fact that when you look at MNCs, right, you don't know the people behind those MNCs.
Correct,
right?
Correct.
There are no real faces which are willing to take accountability. Right? Here, there are real faces who have their own personal stories, who have their own personal values, right, and who are willing to be accountable for what they're doing.
Right?
And I think that part, right, is what a platform like that brought to life, and she got to tell her story. Right? But I think more importantly, as a platform, it's been a great platform to just bring the entrepreneurial conversations, right, onto mainstream. The dining table.
Yeah. Right?
From it being hidden somewhere in newspapers or somewhere in digital, and people of all ages not talking about it, right? Of actually, to a certain extent, even looking down upon it, right? To a stage where actually people are looking up on startups and entrepreneurs, right? Now, if you're an entrepreneur, shayad ladki mil jayegi in terms of getting married.
Yeah.
People won't say that, you know, oh God, he doesn't do anything, right?
Okay.
But it is seen as a respectable way to build your to build a career, to build value for yourself, and to build value for ecosystem. Right? It's not only STEM, but this has also become one of those. So I think that to me is the biggest impact, right? For us, it was a great experience.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think it's made entrepreneurship acceptable as a career pathway and also celebrated in some shape or form, which just motivates a bunch of people to take the risk, which was otherwise looked at something that was monumental in nature, but now is widely accepted. So completely agree. I think I have one last question before we go into the ending portions. The other important, significant piece in the last year was around the IPO that is around the corner. And that happens to be the epitome of success for new age entrepreneurs. Every founder incorporating their company dreams to someday list it at the NSE, at the stock exchange. As you prepare yourself for the process, there was a lot of chatter around it that you've of course addressed. What I want to understand is, what is the mindset shift in your leadership style or running of the company that helps you prepare for becoming a public company? Because now people who will become shareholders are the day-to-day consumers of the product as well. And that is a wide responsibility in itself. So if you can talk to us and address that piece as to how does a company of this scale become ready for an IPO-like event, I think that will be very helpful, Varun.
So I would say the first thing that you need to think of when you answer the question, am I ready to go, you know, IPO or am I ready to go public, especially in an Indian market context, is am I ready to consistently deliver on what I promise, right? And have I understood my playbooks, my markets, right, my execution abilities, my systems, right, enough that I have confidence, right, that I will continue to deliver quarter on quarter on quarter on quarter. Because that's something which the markets expect you to be able to do, right? Which is if you have shown a path, right, they want you to be able to deliver to that path. Right? It is not as strict also in between. If you have a strong realization, if you want to change the strategy, you're most welcome to also come and communicate that change. Right? But once you've communicated it and you've communicated a new path, right, again, you're expected to deliver onto that path. Right? So I think as a founder, as a CEO, right, one of the things that you have to be very confident about, right, is your ability to consistently deliver, you know, the results that you're talking about. And I think for us, last almost 2.5-3 years, right, even when we were not thinking IPO, we were living that life with our board. Right? We have very extensive business planning processes. We come up with monthly, quarterly plans as part of those processes. Right? We expect our leaders to deliver onto those plans, and we don't expect deviations, you know, especially downward deviations. Right? You know, so I think some of that culture, right, of ensuring that we deliver to our plans and we plan in a certain way and the planning itself is rigorous, right, is something that we've been driving some time, right? So that's the one big thing that you need to ask yourself. Are you willing to sort of live that life? Are you ready as an organization to sort of deliver to that? And I think second is just setting up a lot of base systems and processes, right, which demonstrate both control from a business delivery perspective as well as control from governance and other pieces perspective, right? So I mean, from your the right kind of IT processes to right kind of you know, ERP controls, right, to right kind of forecasting processes, etc. So I think last few years we have also spent a lot of time in getting that done. And third is, have I built an organization, right, which can deliver to these goals, right, even if I am not there and I'm not involved, right? And hence, have I built the right kind of leadership team, right, who can take this organization from where we are today, right, to the vision that we have 5 years down the line? Right? I think that's the piece that we have spent a lot of time on over the last 2 years, right, in getting the right people in place and the right roles, right, who are going to sort of drive that agenda. And once the answer to all of these three things is yes, right, then also what you need to think about is, what is it that, you know, so going to public markets, it's basically a financial decision, right? You either do that because as a company you need more financial infusion, right? Which, for example, in our case, we are a profitable company which has very minimal working capital requirements, right? So actually, you know, the requirement for external capital to run our business is very minimal, right? On the other hand, we did raise money from early stage investors, right, since 2017, since we've been sort of, you know, running the operations. And most VCs funds have life of 5 to 7 years, right? Correct. Where then you need to find alternate sort of, you know, partners who can take that ownership and continue to run, right? So it is not like, you know, that will be replaced by, you know, a non-investor. It will still be replaced by an investor, right? Mm-hmm. But an investor who's right for that size and stage of the company. And while the investors which came in who were early stage were right for that stage and size of the company. And so now there is an active churn which is expected to sort of happen as the organization graduates, becomes large, and hence is looking at a very different path. And that's great for the organization also, because the kind of investors which now join the journey understand how to operate and run larger companies, what kind of problems can come, how do they tackle those problems, how to drive even better sort of governance structures, sustainability structures, right, organization structures in these organizations, right? So I think for us, that has been one of the key reasons, right? Again, you can choose to do that privately as well, right? Yeah. And remain private. On the other hand, you know, going public is a part of, you know, growing up as an organization, right? It makes you more accountable. It makes you sort of, you know, more respectable also as an organization, right? And it opens up multiple pools of opportunities around, you know, how and what kind of partners you can attract as a part of this journey. And so, and of course, right, we would love our consumers also to be a part of this journey and, you know, create financial value for themselves, right, as we create value for all our investors, right? So I think that's how at least we thought about this, and that's how we thought about readiness around going public as well.
Got it. No, that's wonderful to know. I think, again, very, very well explained and rounded in terms of how companies can look at going public and what the reasons need to be and how they can understand the predictability of cycles and prepare for it in advance. And lovely to know the financial discipline that's already been exhibited and processes set. I think as we, you know, conclude this episode, I have a bunch of these more succinct questions that I want to ask. These are a set of similar questions that I end up asking that maybe give us a better insight to how you think. But these will be around 7-8 odd questions. Please feel free to take it as you go. But one of the things there, and, you know, this is that question that what do you think you have changed your mind on from when you started to now in a negative way, in the sense that there have been a lot of positive learnings, right? But what was that one thing that you thought was true in 2016, but you now know is not true?
I used to think Indian consumers are price conscious, and I've changed my mind on that. I now think and genuinely believe we are value conscious, right? And as long as a brand or a product, you're delivering value for my money, and I'm willing to pay more money.
Got it. Talking about, you know, insights and what you've changed your mind on, I think one of the Peter Thiel questions is, what is that one truth that you know that the world does not know? What is your answer to that?
Wow. One truth that I know, but the world doesn't know. The entire world doesn't know. Wow.
Maybe this is just an original insight to understand what you have in terms of what others don't intuitively understand. We can circle back. I think one of the other things I'm very curious to know is if you had to choose a consumer product apart from the Mamaearth brand of products, which is your favorite product beyond this suit?
I would say iPhone.
iPhone.
Yeah.
Nice. The other piece that helps us understand more about you is not in your words, but how do others identify with you? So if I had to ask you how your Mamaearth team members would describe Varun, what would you have to say?
I think they would say I am quick to make decisions. Right? Mm-hmm. I don't sit on them. And they would say I am fairly sharp around numbers, right? You know, I'd be able to look at a fully fledged Excel sheet and still be able to say, okay, this is not kind of making sense. And thirdly, they would say I'm fairly impatient for results, right? So wherever wherever folks say that, you know, no, this is how it's been done in the industry, or this is the time that it usually takes, right? I like to challenge those beliefs and I like to break them down and say, okay, no, how can it be done differently? And so I think, yeah, those three.
Got it. So quick decision maker, analytical, you can check any number, and challenging old beliefs. Awesome. I think that templatizes a great founder. The other piece is, you know, you've had this very audacious vision around Mama Earth, and you keep talking about it. And I've heard that a bunch from my research from a bunch of people as well. If you had to, in 30 seconds, summarize what Mama Earth looks like in the next 10 years, right? The point being that we want to audaciously put out the vision and the purpose, which is very strong and true to what you're doing. Yeah. How would you put it?
I think Mama Earth will, in 10 years, be the most loved beauty and personal care brand in the country. And with over 100 million Indians using it. And it'll be available in at least 100 countries across the world. And it'll be one of those brands which brings pride to Indians when they travel outside and they see, hey, this is from our country. And it'll have these forests where you can take your kids, right? Because we've already planted 500,000 trees. Yes. Right? And over the next decade, we'll probably end up planting more than 3 to 4 million trees. And our view is some of them will become like these mini Mammoth forests, right? Where birds, animals, and your kids, right? All can have fun.
That's so lovely. I think you've spoken about it, but I don't know how many consumers know about it. It's on the pack, it's everywhere, but that's one of the best things that I've ever heard a company do. It also includes other initiatives where you, you know,
yes,
go ahead and set
yes.
up like
in fact,
clean
all
water
our,
in villages, all products
absolutely.
Have something.
So all our brands have their own purpose missions, and all our purpose missions are brought to life through technology. And so if, for example, Aqualogica has a mission to provide clean water in villages, right? Our tech actually brings to you the pictures of villagers who have gotten access to this clean water because wow. you bought from Aqualogica. Right? And it hence makes your contribution come to life. Right? Yeah. Be Blunt is on a mission to provide vocational education to women so that they can, you know, have progressive careers. Right? Similarly, Dermaco is on a mission to provide young children in government schools who don't have access to science labs, science education. So all the brands in the company have a mission and we bring it to life through our technology.
That's very heartwarming. I think it remains to be one of the best things I appreciate about any brand in the country. And that's truly inspirational, if I can say that. Towards the end, you know, one thing that a lot of people, at least from the outside, think of is the money aspect and how that relates to founders, right? Especially after a while, right? After the first 5-7 years of a company. What is your relationship with money and how do you define that?
You know, I would quote the great Diljit Dosanjh and say, "Paise puse bare billo soche duniya." Jatt paida hoya billo shaun waste, right? So
yeah.
I think what excites some of us far more is creation. And, that's the big difference between, you know, founders of today versus promoters of yesterday. We are more mission driven. And for us, money, you know, 7 saal pehle naukri kar rahe the, hum matlab theek thi life. And we are much better off financially, no doubt about it. And, God has been great, things have been good, right? But beyond a certain level, we are still fairly middle class. Right? We can't spend beyond a certain level. We still have to evaluate, ye sasta hai, ye mehenga, or this I say, like, discount mein lo, right? I mean, that continues to be a DNA that it's very difficult for us to change from that, right? But the whole space of creation and what we've been able to do with the brands and how much love we've gotten and the fact that, you know, this creation has been able to impact more than 5,000 people in terms of employment, right? And helping them progress in their lives, right? Are things which excite us far more.
Absolutely. I guess that defines, after a point, money only does so much. And that is a living personification of it. For the second last bit, I'm also aware that, you know, you angel invest and you support young founders. And I've been very fortunate to receive your support in what I've been doing with Indian Silicon Valley Capital. If you had to give us, again, very succinctly, factors that you maybe underwrite when you are looking at a company or a founder, when you are trying to envision how big they can become, that'll be really lovely as young founders look to you for, you know, early signals of what great founders look like.
So, from a founder's perspective, I would say, one, how passionately do you understand the problem that you're trying to solve, right? Mm-hmm. Two, what excites you, right? Are you talking about becoming a unicorn, or are you talking about solving that problem at the largest scale?
Right?
What is it that is driving you, right? Three, have you been able to attract the right team members, right, to be a part of this journey? Right? And four, of course, social proofs, which is be traction on your product or your idea, and or the fact that you've been able to attract like-minded investors, right, further gives you belief, right, in their ability to attract consumers, investors, and people in future. And five, I would say, looking at and talking about their past journeys, right, and understanding where they've demonstrated grit. Right? When have they come across moments where things were not going well and they were able to sort of still stand up, fight back, and turn it around? Right? Because that's going to be the journey which they are going to see. So I think that would be
awesome. Passion, grit, and leadership. That's what I took away. I have one last bit, actually, and this is something that you've spoken a bunch about. So I'd love to know your thoughts. But when it comes to trust, right, Mamaearth is now looked at a very trusted brand because of the certification, because of fulfilling promise. This is a constant threat to what you do. If you had to, again, very quickly summarize, what are pillars of building trust with the new age Indian consumer who is aware, who wants to understand what goes behind their products, and then instore this time and again, what would you have to say?
I think the underlying pillar would have to be consistency and quality.
Okay.
Consistency in terms of delivering what you say you will deliver, right? Mm-hmm. And quality in terms of delivering a great product that they enjoy in terms of their consumption. Right? And it takes founder paranoia, right, as well as organizational paranoia, right, to actually get that going, right? I mean, we are so crazy about our QC processes and how we want to deliver what we need to deliver, right? As well as around the fact that, you know, we're not always going to be perfect, right? There will be mistakes, there will be poor experiences, but we have to be very, very conscious in listening to them and making whatever change is required, right? In giving a better experience to the next set of consumers.
Consistency and quality, that's perfect. For the last question, Varun, and, you know, mostly the stereotypical end is, what are the learnings? I'd maybe ante that, because a lot of founders, when they hear you, think about how they want to build brands. But instead of prescribing learnings, I think it'll be better to understand what not to do. So if you can maybe summarize your biggest not to do's in the entrepreneurial journey, I think that would bring us to a great close.
Don't start with the sole objective of making money, right? Or becoming famous, right? Really sort of bad objectives, right? Don't take decisions without listening to your consumer, right? Almost all businesses that we do are human businesses, right? And where either a brand or a product talks to the human, right? And tries to tell a story to the human, and you can do it yourself, right? If you're not able to convince 50 people across the table around what you want to do, then it is going to be very difficult to make a video out of it and then, you know, show it to a million people and then do it, right? No point, right? Don't let go of long term for the short term, right? So, for example, don't bring in an investor who's probably offering high valuation but is not a great long term partner. Mm-hmm. Don't similarly sort of, you know, bring the wrong talent, right? Either too early or too late, right? Because you're thinking short term, right? I think some
that's,
of those.
That's great. Okay. So optimizing for the long run and ensuring that you are not starting up for the financial benefits of it or for the fame of it are my takeaways. Awesome. This has been so nice. Thank you so much, Varun, for being on the show. It means a lot that you agreed to come on again and had such a wonderful chat. I think I got to know so many different things about Mama during this conversation, and I'm glad we could get this conversation in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Awesome.